names, and most of those posthumously. Every warrior in Vedal had been raised on the stories of those mighty few.
I'm unworthy.
I don't care. I merely need the warriors to think you are. That requires status and rank, I suppose. Thus, I promote you to the rank of Fonto with a single star.
Jagdish was speechless.
Fontos were granted between 1 and 5 stars, but even the first tier of that mighty rank led 10 paltons. Even with minimal staff, unreinforced, that was at least 500 warriors.
Oceans!
He wasn't just skipping several ranks. With his lowly birth, it would have taken him 100 years of perfect effort to achieve such a station. He was only a Rizzledar, the lowest form of officer. As a Fonto, he'd have 10 Rizzledars under his command.
I will inform the Vedal High Command about this promotion. They can throw a parade, or whatever it is you warriors do, before they dispatch you to the eastern border, as far from my sight as possible.
Harta looked over Jagdish with barely concealed disgust.
Clean him up. Then the most powerful man in Vedal simply walked away.
Jagdish's knees were quivering. His hands were shaking so badly that the chains were audibly rattling. Apparently, he wasn't the only one who had been absolutely terrified and trying to hide it, because once the Thakor was out of sight, the woman, Radha, stumbled off to the side and loudly threw up in the bushes.
"Sorry about slugging you in the gut earlier," said the guard next to Jagdish as he unlocked the shackles.
"But, brother, I've got to say, that was the most intense promotion ceremony I've ever been to."
Chapter 32. Hair and beard trimmed, bathed, wearing a new sword, and in an opulent uniform with Fonto's badges hastily sewn on each sleeve, Jagdish walked out of Great House Vedal feeling like a new man. There was a star on his turban and a joy in his heart. Several members of the personal guard were waiting for him at the back entrance. They stood at attention and barked his name and rank. It wasn't just because of his newly given status. He knew soldiers well enough to tell these salutes showed real respect. These men were sworn to secrecy about the things they saw within these walls, but despite their knowing how Jagdish had just earned his dubious reward, they still seemed proud that a former member of their unit had made it big. Harta's lies aside, Jagdish was probably the only regular person they'd ever met who'd fought demons and wizards and lived.
"Thank you," Jagdish told the men. "Please, go about your duties."
The guard dispersed, except for the warrior Luthra, who greeted Jagdish with a formal bow.
"Good evening, Fonto. Due to the, suddenness of events, there's no guest room prepared for you here at the Great House. We can provide you quarters at our barracks in the meantime."
Jagdish couldn't help but grin. Luthra was much younger than he was, but he looked to be a sharp one.
"No need to mince words, Havildar. I've been in your boots. You're trying to spare the master of the house the indignity of seeing a scrub like me beneath his roof. No offence is given. I'm so happy to be alive right now that I'd gladly sleep in the dirtiest swine pen in the castless quarter, and I'd still wake up refreshed."
"Sorry, I'm not used to being able to speak freely with a man of such advanced rank as yourself."
Luthra's speech made it obvious he too had earned his obligation through proper soldiering and not being a high-status man's son.
"You're welcome to bunk with us inside the walls until the High Command sends you east. Or, if you've got somewhere else to go in the city, I can loan you a carriage and a driver."
He was so excited to see Pakpa that he would have run to her father's house, even in these new, far too stiff boots.
"Just a horse would be wonderful."
"Consider it done."
Luthra signalled for one of his men to run to the stables.
"I was told that you were asking about the whereabouts of Rizaldar Garish earlier."
"He delivered me to Coldstream. Seemed like a good man."
"The best of us," Luthra agreed. "He's off on a gate inspection, but he's due back later tonight. I can't wait to see his face when I tell him he missed all the excitement."
"I asked him to deliver a personal memento of mine to my wife, and wanted to see if it had been done. But now I guess I get to just go see her myself."
"If Garish the Steadfast said he'd deliver it, then I'm sure it was. Permission to speak freely, sir?"
"Being asked that will take me some time to get used to. Of course, Havildar."
"What the Thakur was saying about the warrior's morale, he's not wrong. You've been away, but the mood's been sour in Vidal City since the business with the Black Heart. It's hard to be betrayed by something you've looked up to your whole life. When word gets out about Angruvadel for sure being gone, they'll be heartbroken. There's not a young warrior in Vidal who didn't at some point dream about being chosen to bear that sword."
"Me as well," Jagdish said softly.
In fact, he'd been on his way to duel for the Black Sword when he'd gotten into all this mess.
"Then you know it'll be good for them to have something else to believe in. To be able to look up and say, 'See that one? He was just like us once.'"
Jagdish was still dizzy with the new responsibilities that had been placed upon him, but Luthra was sincere. His caste truly needed him right now.
"I will do my best."
"I hope so," Luthra laughed. "When I was young, I wanted to be a protector when I grew up.
Every warrior my age will admit they were inspired by Ashok Vidal, if they're honest at least. We do need heroes."
That was a kick to the sack. "But I'll tell you, I've served our Thakur for long enough to know his moods. I thought for sure you were a dead man."
"As for that, who was the woman whose wise counsel saved my life?"
"Radamantha Nems Darhaban of the Capital Library."
"Really?"
Jagdish never figured he'd owe his life, status, and fortune to a librarian.
"Really? And beyond that, I'm not allowed to say how we ended up with her as our guest, even to someone of your newly exalted status.
Please, give her my thanks."
The guard who had run to the stables was returning, leading one of the mares they kept saddled for emergency messengers.
"Not just that.
Tell Lady Radamantha, if she ever needs any favours, anything at all, from the world's most fortunate warrior, Jagdish is at her disposal. I owe her my life. Now, I'm off to see my family." Dignity of his new office be damned, Jagdish was so excited to go home that he rushed to the horse and leapt into the saddle. The poor animal reared in surprise.
"Farewell, lads. Good luck, Fonto."
Jagdish kept it to a trot until he was at the gate, and then he coaxed his horse into a run. Triumphant Jagdish rode through the streets of Vidal City. It would have taken another rain of demons to wipe the grin from his face. He was forced to slow down as he passed by the looming mansions of the First Caste and the big government buildings. Off-duty soldiers saw him, then quickly got out of his way when they saw the insignia of an important man. After he went by, surely they talked, for most of the Fontos were known to them. And who was this man, so young to wear such a distinguished rank? Even a warrior born from the highest bloodline had grey in his hair before reaching that kind of status. Jagdish couldn't help but shout at the warriors who were hurrying to salute him.
"I am Jagdish, and I have returned."
They gaped at him, but they heard, and they understood.
"Let them talk. Let the whole city know. Let everyone speak his name, for Jagdish had returned home with honour."
He'd waded through swamps while wrestling a train of mules to do it. The heaviest weight he'd been dragging that whole time hadn't been demon bone, but the shame of his damaged name. With that weight gone, he felt like he could fly. He was no longer Unlucky Jagdish, or Jagdish the Failure, or even prisoner Jagdish. He was the Fonto Jagdish, hunter of demons and killer of wizards. He would go to the east, where he would serve his house, train his men, and lead by example. There would be raids back and forth, as there always was, and Jagdish would be so devoted to fulfilling his duty that success would be inevitable. Harta hated him, and he would be exiled to the border for now. But Thakurs didn't live forever. Someday, Jagdish would return to this city, and one of these massive estates he was riding past would become his. He and Pakpa would live here, and it would be his children reaping the benefits of having high-status blood. Only unlike most of the fops he'd known, he'd raise his children right, to be proper warriors, not soft and coddled, and they'd have to train hard like everyone else so they could grow up to be leaders deserving of respect. As he crossed through the warriors' district, all the warriors were saying his name. With a thrill, it went through the crowds. Even the workers on the streets knew who he was. If Harta said these men needed a figurehead, then Jagdish would do that job. He'd do it with pride. But not too much pride, because Jagdish knew a leader's biggest job was to serve. He'd give these men pride because pride made the march easier. It made the armor lighter. It made the sword arm strong. Pride kept you alive. Pride had kept him alive. Ahead, he spied a familiar wagon. It was the rig that had just transported him from Coldstream to the Great House Gardens. It was stopped at one of the more popular warriors' halls in the city. He'd once sat in that very tavern and drank until the alcohol had given him enough courage to duel Ashok. It must have been the end of their shift, and the guards had stopped to cash in some of their beer rations before returning to their barracks. It said a lot about his mood that Jagdish didn't dismount, go inside, and use his newfound Fonto powers to have the men who'd abused him mercilessly whipped for their law-breaking. But no. As Harta had shown mercy to him, he would be merciful to them. And as satisfying as it would have been to go in there and challenge them to a duel, Pakpa was waiting. Though perhaps tomorrow he would pay a visit to the warden and educate that officer about the idiocy of having men who rejoiced in cruelty be left in charge of captives. He rode past his old house, though there was nothing for him there now. Pakpa had gone to live with her family in the workers' district. The place had probably been assigned to a different officer, more than likely some other young Rizaldar who'd just had his marriage arranged. Only whoever that stranger was couldn't possibly be as lucky with wedlock as Jagdish had been. It was a tiny home, but it was where he and Pakpa had shared a bed, so it would always be special to him. He would miss this tiny house. But come to think of it, Afonto's stipend was 10 times that of a Rizaldar, so he'd build his bride a new mansion in the east, like she deserved. The workers' district was still loud and bustling, even at night, though it was nothing like the mud and soot-encrusted chaos that was Niramphorn, where he'd spent days hiding in the shadows and sleeping beneath steam vents. Vidal City was bright and clean, with the factory walls covered in flowering vines and decorated with colourful banners advertising their various products and services. "I am Jagdish, and I have returned," he shouted at the batch of tired warriors who were marching out of the district at the end of their patrol. They gawked at him, confused as to why the man in the fancy uniform was yelling triumphantly. But the rest of the people here, when they heard his name, they recognized it. Realization dawned on their faces. This was the hero who'd crossed through several rival houses to make their house rich with demon parts. Gutch had tried to tell him once that most workers couldn't afford pride. That made them harder to build up than a warrior. But that meant they were also harder to tear down. They just got by, good or bad, no matter what, plodding along. But Gutch was wrong. If only Gutch could see the look on his peers' faces, he would see real pride right now. Vidal pride. His name brought them hope. Workers bowed. Their women waved and blew him kisses. Children ran after his horse. Funny, it turned out that workers needed something to believe in too, and his heart rejoiced. Jagdish had succeeded beyond his wildest dreams, and now all the people of Vidal would celebrate with him. A moment later, the estate of Pakpa's father came into view. It wasn't really a house, so much as a giant bakery that they'd added apartments onto for the family living quarters. People were still coming and going, delivering sacks and carrying off baskets. Jagdish came to a stop, got off his horse, and hitched it to a post. He knew many of Pakpa's relatives from the wedding party, but he didn't recognize any of these. The workers looked at him curiously. They might not know warrior ranks, but it was obvious from the ornamentation of his uniform that Jagdish was a very important man. "Is Pakpa here?" They obviously didn't know of who he spoke. "Never mind. Move aside, for I am Jagdish, and I have come to take my wife away from all of this." So excited he could barely think straight, he pushed his way into the bakery. "Pakpa!" Despite the hour, most of the bakers were still there, steadily going about their duties, cleaning vats, sweeping floors, and feeding wood into enormous stoves. It was all very industrious. This place supplied various warrior barracks around the city, and for that Jagdish was very thankful, because his marriage had been arranged to secure a contract between the castes. He owed his happiness to bread.
"Pakpa!"
He didn't see her. But that made sense. She was a new mother, so she probably wouldn't be toiling in front of a hot fire.
"Pakpa!"
He grabbed a passing child by the sleeve, who seemed rather surprised to see a warrior here.
"Have you seen Pakpa?"
The boy shook his head in the negative, frightened.
"Are you sure? She's the daughter of the head baker."
"The boss ain't got no girl here I know of, so warrior."
Confused, Jagdish let go of him. The child was probably just an idiot. He went back to his search.
"Pakpa!"
Another baker intercepted him. This one a short, thick man who was dusted in flour up to his elbows.
"Jagdish, is that you?"
"Aye, it's me."
He'd met this one at the wedding, one of his wife's multitude of cousins, though he'd forgotten his name.
"Sorry, I didn't recognize you in such finery.
I've returned for Pakpa."
The baker's eyes widened as a pained look came over his face.
"You don't know?"
He froze.
"What? Where is she?"
I'm sorry, Jagdish. Pakpa's dead."
His world came crashing down.
The baker kept talking. Something about a difficult childbirth, and them calling for the surgeon, but how no one arrived in time.
Only Jagdish was having a very hard time understanding the words. The room began to spin. He had to grab onto a table edge as his knees went weak. Flour got all over his new coat. He nearly fell. The baker reached for him, but Jagdish shoved him away.
"No."
He couldn't breathe in here. There was too much dust or something. He was choking. Jagdish made it out the door. He tried to gasp for air, but it was like there was nothing there. This wasn't thick, moist Vidal air anymore. It was like the high, sharp air of the mountains that cut your face. Heart hammering, he stumbled down the boardwalk until he couldn't walk, so he sat on the edge and tried to comprehend the incomprehensible. The bakers came outside after him, a bunch of them now. Like before, the workers were saying his name, only this time it wasn't with awe, but rather pity.
"Pakpa,
No. It can't be.
They were all babbling, but it might as well have been some gibberish tongue for how little of it made sense. Someone was touching him on the shoulder, and he realized it was Pakpa's mother. She was weeping. She'd had months to get over her shock and grief for her daughter. This was a fresh, sad cry for him.
"This is a mistake. You must be wrong," he told them.
Only the truth was plain on their faces. She was gone. And he hadn't been here. She was gone because he hadn't been here. If he'd been here, then surely he would have been able to do something. His presence had reawakened her family's grief, and the bakers began to wail and carry on. Sick and angry, he shouted, "No!" Jagdish struck the boardwalk with his fist. It caused the nearest workers to flinch away in fear.
"No, no, no!"
He kept punching the wood until Pakpa's mother forgot her place and grabbed his arm before he broke his fingers. She babbled something in his ear, meant to be soothing, but Jagdish couldn't understand her over the sobbing. There was the sound of hoofbeats as another rider approached.
"Make way! Coming through!"
Dazed, he wondered why he could understand a warrior's words, but not those of the workers. It must be a matter of tone. Or perhaps he had just trained himself to always listen to his comrades, no matter how dire the situation was. Jagdish looked over to see a grizzled warrior in the uniform of the personal guard parting the crowd. His horse had obviously been pushed hard. This man had been desperate enough to move through the streets at a speed dangerous to bystanders. When the new arrival saw Jagdish sitting there without dignity, he swore.
"Oceans, I'm too late." "Girish?" Jagdish asked,
confused as to what the man he'd asked to deliver his pocket watch was doing here. The senior warrior dismounted.
"When Luthra told me you'd been released, I tried to catch up to warn you." "You knew about Pakpa? Why? Why didn't you tell me?" "I thought you were going to be executed soon. I didn't want to torment a condemned man with news he could do nothing about."
Girish approached with hands spread apologetically.
"I am truly sorry."
This made Jagdish furious, but if their roles had been reversed, he knew he probably would have done the exact same thing. It was a good thing for Girish and Jagdish both that he kept his head, even when the world was falling apart all around him.
"I should have been here, Girish. I wasn't here. She can't be gone. This is a bad dream. I'll wake up soon. I was going to take her away and build her an estate in the east. I can do that for her now, so we can raise a proud family."
The change had been so sudden. Moments ago, he had been atop the world, and then he'd been cast into the oceans to sink beneath the waves of hell. Then a terrible realization struck him. Pakpa had been in childbirth. And he turned to Pakpa's mother, frightened.
"What happened to my son?"
"That's what I've been trying to tell you, Jagdish," she said. "You've got no son."
He'd not just lost the woman he'd loved, but the son he'd never even had the chance to love. He'd not thought he could feel any worse. But suddenly he was crushed with a despair beyond imagination. It was as if a hail of arrows had just pierced his chest, and all he could breathe was fire through the holes in his lungs. Jagdish had never felt so alone.
"You've got a daughter."
Chapter 33. The Keeper of Names should have been happy. It seemed the gods were well pleased with their chosen people, The prophet had returned and brought the Forgotten's warrior with her. She'd miraculously cured them of the miserable, lingering illness. The dying had stopped. The people had rejoiced. Their population had surged as the multitude of faithful Thera had brought with her moved in. They had plenty of land, with rich soil already irrigated and fields free of rocks. Javad had organized the newcomers by their skills, and now the terraces were flourishing. They were promised a bounteous harvest. It had been a winter of murder and a spring of plague, but the faithful had survived to see another season. He should have been giving thanks to the gods. Only rather than joy, Keita was engulfed in a deep melancholy he couldn't shake. Though he knew his feelings were profoundly illogical, such understanding changed nothing. He felt what he felt, even if it wasn't the god's will he do so. The voice had commanded him to go and find Ashok, because it prophesied that Ashok alone could lead their armies against the capital. Keita had crossed the continent and risked his life to get to the former protector, only to find their chosen in prison. Once free, Ashok had lived up to his dark reputation as the most dangerous man in Lok. At first, he had repeatedly threatened to kill poor, unassuming Keita. Yet Keita had remained steadfast, knowing that, no matter how unlikely it was that the law's ultimate killer was supposed to turn into the rebellion's champion, the gods would not lead them astray. It had eventually worked out. They had even become friends, of a sort. That made the discovery that Thera had fallen in love with Ashok even more painful. The revelation should not have stung. Rather, he should have been happy for both of them. Thera was the best woman he had ever known, a prize that any rational man who could look past her obstinate ways would want as a wife. It was no surprise that a man accustomed to the highest status would pair off with the most important woman in the world. Of course Thera had chosen Ashok instead of someone like Keita. How could she not? Even though castes weren't supposed to matter here, and despite he and Ashok both legally being the lowest of the low, Ashok still acted as if he was the highest of the high. It wasn't pride either. If it had been, Keita would have a reason to hate him. In fact, it was the opposite, with Ashok despising himself because of the fraud of his birth. Despite that, Ashok remained instinctively noble, aloof, sometimes even cruel, but never with intent toward cruelty. He was confident, yet did not brag. Ashok simply told the truth as he saw it. Swordless, he still carried himself with the dignity of a bearer. Lawless, everything he did retained the moral conviction of a judge. They had both come from nothing. Only Ashok's memories had been erased by wizards to hide the scandal of Angruvadel choosing a little castless blood scrubber to wield it. Keita remembered all of his life. The squalor, the hunger, the regular tragedies and daily indignities. He remembered well the constant gnawing fear that was the life of non-person, and had the whip scars on his back to prove it. Legally, they were less valuable than livestock, so of course Castless didn't marry. Despite the law, they still paired off and loved each other and made children just like the real people. Sometimes these castles even managed to stick together in the semblance of what whole men would think of as families. He had recorded hundreds of examples of this into the great book since becoming the Keeper of Names. As for him, however, Keita had been with several castles women. He might even have left one of them with a baby for all he knew, assuming any of them had survived the uprising in Utara. But he'd never really known them. Their names, and how they felt in the dark, that was about it. The relationships had been brief, lustful encounters, and then they'd been sent off to other masters and never seen again. Now he was a free man, and an important one at that. Yet on the road with Thera, once of the warrior caste, he'd often felt like an impostor. Though he'd tried to put it aside, sometimes Keita still reflexively returned to the submissive meekness that every non-person learned to adopt around their betters in order to survive, and he hated himself for it. When they'd first met, he'd found Thera to be abrasive and self-centered. She should have been thankful for the gift she'd been given, but was instead angry at the very gods for picking her. Then he'd come to understand that she was a product of her past, just as he was. There was far more to her than she'd let people see, and over time he'd come to respect her determination. On their long journey, respect had turned to love. Except Thera was the prophet, and he was her priest, so he'd said nothing. He didn't even know if such feelings were appropriate or not. The gods certainly hadn't said anything about it. Would they approve? Unsure, he hesitated. The Keeper of Names was always confident and certain. Keita was not. They were the same person, but two very different things. The Keeper of Names was the High Priest of the Returned Forgotten, who taught all who would listen with a passion that swayed even the hardest heart. Keita the man was small, balding, and not particularly noteworthy. After being kidnapped by wizards, the Keeper of Names demanded their prophet be retrieved because she was the voice of the gods who could guide them with the wisdom of the gods. Keita had simply wanted Thera back. Perhaps, in a small way, he'd assumed if they were together, eventually Thera would grow to feel about him the way he felt about her. That had been the lazy decision of a coward. Even when she'd cured his sickness by her touch, in that moment when he had loved her more than ever, and she had shone like the heavenly messengers Ratul had talked about, he had still hesitated to tell her the truth. Not that it would have done any good. He'd not known that Ashok had already bedded her then. Keita only would have embarrassed himself. Of course Thera had chosen Ashok. He was the sort of man who made the people wish to be ruled by kings. So be it. He would continue to serve her because the Forgotten willed it. Enough self-pity. Keita had a religion to manage.
Good morning, Keeper,
Javed said as Keita walked into the large room that served as their church. There was very little furniture in the cove, so most of his preaching was done with the faithful sitting on the stone floor. Many of the various trinkets and artifacts the people had brought with them had been placed here for worship. Some of these were new, while others had been kept hidden from the Inquisitors and been handed down in secret through the ages. Like the little statues of men with elephant heads, or beautiful women with extra arms, or the smiling fat man, and even one with a man, probably castless since he was so skinny and dressed only in a loincloth, with his hands nailed onto some sort of Inquisition torture device. The old symbols were all so different in style that at times Keita suspected they had no relation to each other at all, and he still had no idea which of these, if any, was the physical representation of the voice.
Javed!
He greeted the man who had become his right hand over the last few months. A great many of them owed their lives to the former rice merchant, not just for saving them from the fat wizard who'd hunted them for sport during the winter, but also for the incredible work he'd done since.
All is well, I hope?
It is. The newcomers are still working hard. Some of those formerly of the warrior caste were a little haughty about doing manual labour, but all it took was a word from Ashok, and they've put their shoulder to the wheel.
Keita smiled.
It was good sometimes for the warriors to be reminded that the only caste that existed in the cove was freemen, equal below the gods. The people seem happy. Morale is high. That's mostly your doing, Keeper.
My actions are mostly symbolic, Keita said dismissively.
You've helped orphans find new parents to take them in. You've performed ceremonies and blessed the crops. Your preaching is especially valuable. Almost everyone stops what they're doing to hear your words. Even the once mute slaves the voice freed from the lost house are waking up and occasionally speaking a bit now and then. All of this is because of your ministering to the cove.
Keita accepted the compliment. Very few knew how much exhausting effort he had put into making this settlement work.
As have you, my friend. Is there anything else that requires my attention today?
One of the sons of the Black Sword has pronounced his undying love for another of the faithful, and the two wish to be officially married before the gods.
Huh. Keita smiled.
That is unexpected news. Which ones? Ongud, that brown-faced Akashani clerk, and Kalki, the potter from the Swamp People.
Even in the most trying of circumstances, life goes on.
Keita had married people before, but those had been rushed affairs during desperate times. In the law-abiding world, it was arbiters who approved marriages arranged by house and caste. They had none of that here, but strangely enough, it was one of the very first things the faithful had begged their Keeper of Names to do for them. He didn't even know if it was really part of his intended duties or not, but it made the people happy to feel the gods had blessed their union.
The sons are beloved figures. This will be a celebration. Would you take care of scheduling that for me?
Of course, Keeper. There is one other pressing matter, though. We're going to need to send someone out to purchase certain supplies soon.
Keita frowned. They had been sealed off for months, but every time they drained the lake, it risked discovery.
Ashok is certain the protectors are still searching the region.
I defer to your wisdom, Keeper. It is dangerous, but we need a great many things that we simply lack the resources to make here ourselves. Tools, tack. The sons have weapons in need of repair. Of the new arrivals, we've got a smith, but no anvil, and we have a brewer with no...
Wait, we have a brewer? Of beer?
Yes, as well as other spirits that are popular in Akashan, but
I didn't know we had a brewer.
Keita was truly happy for the first time in days. Of course, they had alcohol in the cove, because if there was a plant that could be fermented, the castless knew how to make a drink out of it. However, travelling across Loch, pretending to be a man of status, had spoiled Keita to such luxuries as drink that didn't taste of dirty feet.
Take from the banknotes Thera liberated from the wizards, and use whatever's necessary to get that man any equipment he needs.
As you wish, Javid said.
I've already made a list. It'll take at least 2 of the wagons and 5 or 6 men. But there's always merchant caravans moving across the Darvan Bench this time of year, so they should be able to find what we need without showing their faces in any of the nearby cities.
Good idea.
He didn't know what he would do without Javid.
Keita himself was very skilled at organizing and record-keeping. His meticulous running of a storehouse was the reason he'd been one of the rare castless allowed to learn how to read, write, and do math. But with most of his attention being consumed seeing to the spiritual needs of their people, it was good to have someone else competent to manage the day-to-day things. In fact, now that there were so many people in need of ministering, Keita could barely keep up. He'd been thinking that the time had come to expand their fledgling order. Their priesthood didn't really have an organization. If a real hierarchy existed, the voice had not seen fit to reveal it yet. But Keita intended to offer Javid some sort of priestly title to make his status official. Surely the gods knew the man was worthy of it.
I will prepare an expedition, then. Don't worry.
I'll choose someone clever to be in charge, with at least one or two of them worker caste, so we can purchase things without being suspicious.
Excellent. If there's nothing else pressing, I need to prepare tonight's sermon.
Coming up with an entire religion worth of doctrine was rather a lot of work. Ratul had only told Keita a few of the old stories and the time they'd had together, and what the faithful had handed down in secret through the ages was often conflicting or downright odd. With hundreds of new faithful, he'd spent a great many hours updating the names and family lines in the genealogy, but there was nothing in Ratul's old demon-hide-bound book that answered Keita's deepest questions.
"Will it be about life after death again?" Javad asked.
"That's the topic which gives them the most hope. The ancients obviously believed it, but the voices said very little about the specifics. Our bodies are just meat, but while the law says the spark dies with it, I say the spark lives on. Where does the life go? Some of the faithful think we go to paradise to dwell with the gods in luxury. Others think that life goes into a baby, and you live another life, over and over, until you get it all right."
"Absurd," Javid snorted.
"Javid?"
It was a rare display of disrespect from his assistant.
"Followers of the Forgotten can't insult other faithful's beliefs. This leads to division."
"Forgive me, Keeper. As I told you, many of the caravans believed in the old ways, but my mother never spoke of such things as being born over and over. That makes no sense. Babies are very dumb. For this to be true, babies would be clever. I mean no disrespect to our brothers and sisters who believe such tripe, but I find the idea silly."
Keita would never be so quick to dismiss any of the faithful's traditions.
"A few years ago, he hadn't even heard of Ramroan, and yet he had inherited his priesthood's highest office."
"We won't know for sure until the voice tells us. In the meantime, regardless of which theory is right, telling the people that they've been lied to about the great nothing after death, when there is actually a great something, is an incredible motivator."
"Of course, Keeper."
Keita stopped by the statues when he saw that one of his people had placed a new token next to the old ones. It was a little metal hook to symbolize when the gods had brought Ashok back to life.
"A powerful idea indeed."
"Truly the Forgotten is merciful," Javid agreed. "Have you tried asking about the specifics?"
"Ah,"
Keita shrugged. In truth, he had been avoiding Pharaoh lately.
"The gods speak when they want to be heard. You can't rush them."
"Do you mean the voice, or the prophet who contains it?"
Keita didn't rightly know, but he doubted he'd have much luck pushing either. Receiving the ancient healing knowledge had left her weak and exhausted for days, but Thera appeared rested now. After so much turmoil, she even seemed content. Keita didn't want to ruin that for her. Let her be happy, as she shared her bed with another.
That thought made Keita scowl at the hook.
"The prophet will do what she wants, as she always does."
"Of course."
Javid tilted his head towards the chapel's entrance.
"We have a visitor."
The tall, lean shadow darkening the doorway was unmistakably that of Ashok Vidal, a rare sight in the church, for Ashok was probably the least faithful person in the cove. It was odd. Keita was devout in all his doings, but too timid to act because he was worried the gods wouldn't approve, while Ashok paid the gods no heed at all, and they granted him power over death itself.
"Ah, Ashok! What brings you to the church this fine morning?"
"We must speak of your defences."
Ashok walked in, saw the line of statues, and scowled. Though he was unquestionably dedicated to Thera, it was obvious that the sight of so many illegal artifacts still caused a reflexive revulsion in the former protector.
What about our defences?
They are inadequate. Ashok resisted the urge to stomp on the trinkets and turned back to Keita. It is only a matter of time until the law finds this place.
The gods have kept us hidden from their eyes so far.
A vast country, a sparse population, and luck have done that more than your gods. The lake covers your entrance, but we have no roof to hide beneath. There are wizards who can turn into hawks to ride high on the mountain winds. I thought inquisitors shape-shifting into birds, snakes, and cats was a story mothers tell their children to make them afraid of the capital, Javid said. Ashok shook his head. The power is real. I'm surprised one of them hasn't flown over this crater yet. There is no way to conceal all of our activity forever, so we must decide what to do when they find us.
Everyone here is willing to fight, plus we have your fearsome Sons of the Black Sword now, Keita said.
The Sons are good, Ashok allowed.
One might even say miraculously good, Keita suggested.
Jagdish taught them well, and they fight with remarkable skill and dedication. But they are few in number. When the capital discovers this place, they will send an overwhelming force to crush us. I have some ideas to improve our defences, but I believe they will be insufficient to resist an actual siege.
The gods led us here for a reason.
Ratu led you here because it was convenient.
Ashok's lack of respect for his old master annoyed Keita. Have you asked the voice? You're with her every night, after all. Keita didn't know why he added that last part in a snide tone. It just slipped out. He immediately regretted it. Javid must have caught the jealousy in Keita's voice and gave the keeper a curious look. But Ashok didn't seem to notice at all.
I have not asked, Thera. I do not put as much stock into the enigmatic riddles the voice dispenses as you do. I have come because once you proclaimed there was a prophecy that when the time came, the gods would provide us with weapons that could defeat even the forces of the law. I believe that time will be upon us soon. Was that an idle boast, or do you actually have a plan?
He knew Ashok intended no offense, but that didn't change the sting. It was as if he were saying Keita had done nothing here. This marvellous society outside the law had just sprung into existence all by itself.
The gods don't make idle boasts, Ashok. You should know that by now. They've already begun providing weapons to ensure our freedom, and I'm sure there will be more to come. Let's go right now. I'll show you.
He had never spoken of this secret to anyone else, but it was time. Keita walked out of the church.
Curious, Ashok followed,
as did Javid.
Good. Let them all see that he had not spent this time idle. He had been hard at work long before any of them had ever become involved in the gods' great work. Javid, would you kindly get a few men with shovels? And Ashok, you will want your war leaders to see this.
They set out upon the single road that wound down the crater. To the right were the buildings carved by the ancients, imposing and mysterious, while toward their left was the pit. To step off here would mean a steep drop to the next terrace down, or, if you got enough of a running start, perhaps all the way to the hot lake at the bottom. Keita didn't know much about construction, but enough to know that this place was truly remarkable. If it wasn't for the dam and reservoir above them, and the drainage tunnels to divert the overflow, most of the crater would be filled with water. It was truly a miracle the valves still worked. He had seen the legendary architecture of Vidal's city. The buildings in the cove, even though rather plain and square in comparison to the ornate carved facades of the Vidal, were every bit as big and probably far sturdier. The same road circled the interior all the way down, 13 levels, and somehow maintained a nearly continuous gentle grade. The road surface was made of layer upon layer of gravel and tar. Both materials had probably come from the interior of the crater, since there were dig pits along the interior and an oil seep that had turned the lowest terrace into a marshy bog. The cove was truly a blessed place, with seemingly endless resources. The ancient dam fed them clean water, the slopes had plenty of trees to cut, and they could even get oil for their lanterns below. Even during the bitter winter, the lake at the bottom remained steaming hot. Warm air rose up the pit and kept the place temperate. Even with the new arrivals, the place wasn't even close to crowded. The castlers still liked to sleep piled up in the same room because it was what they were used to, but they could spread out and live like the first caste, everyone in their own quarters if they felt like it. There were hundreds of rooms, and still more being discovered all the time. The thing they'd not found yet was another way out. There was the main drainage tunnel, and that was all. Perhaps someone like Ashok could scale the rocks above, or a wizard could fly out, but for the rest, the cove was besieged. There would be no escape. Ratul, recognizing that weakness, had prepared a way for the faithful to defend themselves. Keita had found the instructions the previous keeper had left behind, but had not tried to use them yet. Ratul had been very specific that they should not reveal these tools too early, because then the rebellion would squander them piecemeal, like they had in the past. By the time he reached their destination, they had drawn a bit of a crowd. Javed had gathered a few freemen and their tools. Ashok had found one of his Havildars, the polite young man from Karsuan, thankfully, instead of the tattoo-faced maniac Somsak. And several of the faithful had seen them walking, become curious, and tagged along. There was a patch of flat dirt at the end of the top level. If they had been in a regular city, it would have been thought of as an empty lot. Nothing grew here but weeds. Keita counted off a careful 20 paces toward the center, prayed to the gods that Ratul's note had been accurate, and ordered, "Dig here." The laborers had no idea what was going on, but they did as he directed. Ashok watched, mildly amused. "What manner of treasure did your gods leave us that it needed to be planted in the soil?" "Perhaps it is a potato," Javed said. Ashok actually laughed. "The gods didn't plant it," Keita said defensively. "Keeper Ratul did." Ashok's laughter died. That had gotten his attention. The hole got deeper and deeper until the diggers were waist deep. When one of the castlers grew weary in the sun, the warrior Eklavia jumped into the hole and took over for him. And when the other did too, Javed took his shovel. Time passed, but the two of them were strong and eager to see what was down there.
"It looks like they are digging a grave," Ashok suggested.
"A grave for the law, maybe," Keita thought, and then wondered how he could work that symbolism into his next sermon. 4 feet down, one of the shovels hit something solid. Eklavia scraped at it, then declared, "It's wood!" Javed thumped it with his shovel and was rewarded with a hollow thunk.
"I think it's a crate."
"No," Keita corrected. "It's a trapdoor. You'll need to clear it all off so we can open it." He turned to one of the faithful women who had been watching. "Shalini, would you fetch us a rope?" Ashok looked down the row of buildings that had been carved from the rock, and then noted how this one rectangular area was suspiciously empty.
"Ratul buried a house."
"Only a small one. Ratul was a very busy man. He said it had probably been a root cellar. He buried it only after he filled it with potent weapons delivered by the gods themselves. It has been sealed to protect them from the elements." Ashok jumped down into the hole.
"Give me that," he said as he took Eklavia's shovel and went to work.
Their general moved with such inhuman energy that the other men simply had to get out of the way. A few minutes of Ashok's frenzied labor was equivalent to what a regular man could do in half an hour. Once the hatch was mostly uncovered, Ashok pried up one edge with the shovel blade, leveraged it up enough to get his fingers in, then wrenched it free. It still had hundreds of pounds of dirt on it, but Ashok didn't seem to notice. Keita walked to the edge and looked down. It was very dark inside, but he could make out a stone floor below. Ashok didn't wait for the rope. He simply stepped into the dark. It was a good 8-foot drop, but he landed softly. Keita could see their general turning in a slow circle as he took in the contents. Then he moved out of sight. There was the sound of heavy wood being dragged across stone. A moment later, Ashok swore.
Salt water!
What is it?
Keita called.
Get down here, Kiva, now!
Shalini had come back with a rope. Eklavya secured it, and Javid tried to help Keita down. He brushed his assistant's hand away. Keita was not by nature an athletic man, but he could scale a rope just fine. The air was choked with fresh dust, and the motes swam through the beams of sunlight.
It's very dark in here, Keita muttered as his sandals hit the floor. We need a lantern.
No fire, Ashok snapped.
Then he thought better of it, raised his head toward the light and bellowed,
Eklavya, allow no lanterns, no torches or sparks anywhere near here.
Yes, sir.
Ashok grabbed Keita by the sleeve.
Try not to move in a way that makes static.
Keita was not sure what that meant, so he kept perfectly still. The air felt very cool and dry, probably why Ratul had picked this particular hole. As his eyes adjusted, he realized that the room looked much like every other one the ancients had carved, but it was much bigger than expected. There were wooden casks stacked along one wall, and rectangular crates and square boxes against the other.
Ashok had pulled the lid off one of the big ones.
Inside the crate were fortress rods, the long type, side by side, packed in what appeared to be grease. He'd seen these things before, even used one himself once to try it out. It had punched him in the shoulder hard enough to leave a bruise, and had made his ears ring for a day, and his target, a melon, had exploded rather spectacularly. The rebellion had acquired nearly 20 of the frightening devices over the years from the crazed alchemists of Fortress. Their strange island was just off the ice coast of Akershan. But those 20 weapons were spread all over the great house, and they'd probably lost half of them when Chakma was retaken. There were 6 in this one box alone. Then Keita realized there were many more of that same crate size. He counted 10. They must have been thinking of the same question because Ashok pulled the lid off the next crate with his bare hands. It should have taken a pry bar because of the nails, but Ashok didn't care. Inside were 6 more of the devastating fiery arms. Then Ashok tried one more crate and found the same number inside. That meant
60 rods. Oceans.
Ratul really had been busy. Then Keita turned toward the wall with all the casks and realized those must be filled with the deadly black fortress powder which burned with a fire so intense and rapid that it obliterated anything nearby. No wonder Ashok had shouted his warning about fire. The last time Ashok had dealt with the stuff, it had blown a mansion to pieces and left him buried in the rubble for days. Keita and Thera had been taught how to make fortress powder years ago by a cagey old rebel who had claimed to have learned it from an actual fortress alchemist hiding somewhere in Lok. It wasn't that complicated, really. Dehydrated stale piss, sulfur, and charcoal in the right proportions. But they'd only ever made a few jugs of the stuff. The quantity stored in here was simply insane in comparison.
Ashok broke open one of the smaller boxes with his heel. Then he reached inside and pulled out a fistful of something. Keita squinted to see, so Ashok stuck his hand into the light. They were balls of grey lead. Ashok gave Keita a pained look as he let them drop from his fingers. They hit the stone and rolled away, one by one. Disgusted, Ashok wiped the grey residue they left on his hand onto his pants.
"There is nothing more illegal than this," Ashok whispered. "I've never heard of so many of these things in one place at a single time. This is profound evil."
"The law says our very existence is evil, Ashok. Mine, yours, theirs, all these good people counting on us. And that existence will end if we can't defend ourselves. These things are no different in principle than a crossbow, just stronger and louder, and they're far less dangerous than your beloved Engruvidal was. The important thing isn't what they can do, but what the warriors think they can do. Once they know we have these, even the capital will be afraid to come against us."
"I do not like this," Ashok muttered.
"Don't let your heart be bothered. The weapon is only as evil as the man who bears it."
Keita couldn't find his voice to proclaim his own desires, but the Keeper of Names did not hesitate to speak with fire and passion in defense of the faithful.
"Let us vow to use these for good, only for self-defense, only to save innocent lives."
Ashok seemed unconvinced, but he had no choice. He was a slave to his vows. Keita was the real free man here. "I've sworn to protect the Prophet, and by extension, her people. But this," he gestured at the rods, "this fills me with unease. This changes everything."
"Why? Because with them our casteless rabble actually stands a fighting chance against the mighty forces of the law?"
Ashok thought about it for a long, painful moment.
"Exactly.
I told you the gods would provide."
Chapter 34 Vidal City was a loud, busy place. One of the biggest and most crowded cities in all of Locke was not enjoyable for a man who preferred quiet contemplation. He had grown tired of the constant chatter and hum weeks ago. It was probably one of the richest cities, too, with vast markets that rivaled even the capital's legendary bazaars. It was said you could buy anything in the markets of Vidal City if you knew where to look. There were thousands of people coming through here every day, buying, selling, haggling, and thieving. Nobody noticed just another leprous beggar. Covered in dirty rags from head to toe, the beggar sat in the shade of a brick wall. On the other side of the wall was a smith who specialized in repairing tools of the worker caste. The constant hammering was making it more difficult for him to eavesdrop on the conversations on the fourth floor of the building across the street. But since this position enabled him to see the only exits, it was still the best place to wait. The beggar had set a tin cup in front of him. It was empty. Vidal City was wealthy, but they had no charity for a beggar who just sat there. In this colourful place, even their lepers had to be entertaining if they expected scraps. The ones who sang songs or danced for people's amusement, their cups got coins, and occasionally a whole note even. He had never learned to dance, plus he didn't dare stand up, because then people would notice how alarmingly large he was. His deep voice was surprisingly good for certain songs, hardy, western marching songs mostly, but he did not wish to draw that much attention to himself. The snake charmers made good money, it seemed. They played flutes, and the people were always excited at the opportunity to see a cobra bite someone. Even the beggars who crawled along on mouldering stumps, telling sob-inducing stories designed to elicit pity, got something dropped in their cups. He got nothing, because he just sat there, trying not to be noticed. He made a terrible beggar. It was a good thing he had been obligated to a different career in his youth. Across the street was a textile shop. The apartments above it were rented out to merchants and travellers, and sometimes Inquisition witch hunters pretending to be merchants, which was what brought him here today. The topmost floor had windows which granted a view of the walls and towers of the magnificent great house less than a quarter mile away. It was a good staging area if your primary mission was to spy upon the keep itself, especially since from the top floor you could sneak out onto the rooftops at night to peer down into the grounds. The Tiger Man and some of his lackeys had been staying there for the last month, which meant the beggar had been here slightly less time than that, because it had taken him a few days to track them down. Lying in garbage and soiled rags that hid all but his eyes for weeks on end didn't leave much time for other activity. But this beggar was a man of single-minded determination. Whenever the watch came by and prodded him with their spear shafts to check if he was still alive, he would move enough to let them know they didn't need to call for the corpse collectors quite yet. When he was sure the inquisitors on the fourth floor were sleeping, he would get up and find something to eat, since he couldn't just obligate some lesser status person to give him nourishment on demand, as he was used to. Eating usually meant picking things out of the trash that would make a fish eater vomit. On the bright side, he was immune to illness, though eating garbage still made his stomach ache. Discomfort was part of the job. He had done worse. Even though it was a few hours after sundown, the market remained busy. The capital market stayed open all night because it was so damnably hot there that the people became almost nocturnal, sleeping through the worst of the unforgiving sun. The Dal had wonderful weather year-round. These people had no excuse for conducting business at inappropriate times. They were addicted to trade. In the far west, where he was from, people kept sensible hours, rising with the sun and not staying up too late, so they would be able to labor in the fields again the next day. In Utara, even the warriors and the first caste kept farmers' hours. But not for Dal City. There was no time for sleep, only trading and music. These people never seemed to stop with the singing. So it was difficult to weed out the hundreds of other excited voices to focus in on the magical conversation that was happening on the fourth floor. Luckily, the witch hunter had left the window open. It was barely a whisper, audible only because of the heart of the mountain. He could tell that the words were being delivered by magic, an extremely expensive method of communication. Thus, this message must be an important one. Once he recognized the magical voice as belonging to Grand Inquisitor Armand himself, his suspicions were confirmed. Koja, we have found Vikram Akarshan. He does not appear to have the mirror, nor was it at the bottom of Red Lake. I must assume that he has given it to the librarian. I am aware of the risk, but you must strike as soon as possible. See if she has the mirror. That is the most important thing. Take her, alive, preferably, and bring her back to the dome for safekeeping. If you are unable to do so, make her death look like the fault of the Vidal. It is vital that you are not caught. It is better to die quietly than to be discovered as one of us. If taken alive, you will be disavowed. I know you will succeed, though, because you are one of my best students. Good luck. That was all the beggar needed to hear. As he stood up and stretched, his back cracked.
After a month of shambling about hunched over, it was the first time he'd shown anyone in the market his full, rather impressive height. Several people noticed him, because they were not used to shaggy lepers, a full head taller than most. Rather than walk across the street, he turned and went into the smith's shop. A bell rang as he opened the door.
"Excuse me," he said to the waiting customers as he cut in line.
Because of his stink and the filth upon his rags, the workers quickly tried to get out of his way.
"Be gone, untouchable!"
the smith shouted, as he did every time he'd seen the beggar around his place of business. But then the expression on the man's face changed when he saw the sudden difference in the beggar's demeanour. Like most smiths, he was well-muscled, but it was plain, just from the sheer presence of the man, that this beggar could snap him like a twig. This was no mangy stray, as believed, but a deadly wolf. It was amazing the difference just standing straight did. Good posture was very important.
"I need to borrow a hammer."
He didn't speak like a humble, down-on-his-luck dreg of society, but rather a man of status.
"What?" "A hammer. All of my weapons and armor were on a pack horse. I believe it was eaten by a magical tiger. It's a long story. I would show you the token of my office to make this official, but it was on the same horse. Hurry up. I need to go kill someone. Give me a hammer. Now!"
His words and demeanor frightened the other customers, and the bell rang again as some workers fled out the door, probably to get the guard. The smith was rather confused by all this, but he didn't argue with the suddenly frightening giant in rags. Instead, he went back into his forge and called out,
"What kind of hammer?" "The biggest one you have."
The smith returned a moment later.
"How about this one?"
He took it from the smith's hands and hefted it. It was about a 2-pound head, on a handle of about 8 inches of stout hickory. It wasn't a proper war hammer, but it would have to do.
"Acceptable."
Then he noticed that the smith had retreated back behind his counter. There was a great number of powders and concoctions for the searing and staining of metals on the shelf behind him. He pointed with the hammer.
"Is that red powder the kind that makes smoke that burns your eyes out?" "Yes, it's for the etching of zinc or steel. The green is for copper."
He stuck the hammer through his belt and then grabbed both bottles from the shelf.
"Be careful! If those two mix together, they'll make a caustic cloud that'll rip our lungs apart." "Excellent. This will be all. How are you going to pay for those?" "I'm not." "Who are you?"
the smith stammered.
"Protector of the law, 19-year senior, Kano Utara."
The bell rang as he left. Kano walked across the street and into the textile shop, which, once again, upset the clean and non-stinking customers.
"You can't come in here, leper!"
the shopkeeper shouted.
"I'll call the watch!" "Send for the corpse collectors as well," Kano said, as he made his way between the shelves of colourful fabrics. "They will be needed."
He walked up the stairs, each heavy footfall slow and methodical. There was no need to rush. Koja would need time to gather all his inquisitors in the city. It would be very difficult to get into the well-guarded great house, and if they made it out with Rada alive, they would still need to exfiltrate the city. They would not attack until the darkest, sleepiest part of the night, when the personal guard would be sleepy and vulnerable. There were 2 rooms on the top floor, both rented by inquisitors pretending to be something else. Kano had watched their comings and goings. Even without their masks, they were easier for him to spot. Predators recognized other predators. Unless, of course, one of them was wrapped in rags and lying in a gutter. But most people were not as dedicated to their work as blunt Kano. The witch hunter must have been eager to get started because he had already dispatched one messenger. Kano heard the slap of sandals rushing down, so he put the jars of poison off to the side, squeezed his bulk into the corner beneath the stairs of the second floor, and waited. The Inquisitor was a young man that Kano had seen many times over the last few weeks. He had never left anything in the beggar's cup. As he rushed past, Kano stepped out, wrapped one massive arm around his neck, and hoisted him from the ground. He didn't even need to use the Heart of the Mountain for that. Kano was simply that strong. To his credit, the Inquisitor was tough, so rather than panic, he kicked Kano in the leg, a move which was basically useless against a man of his density, while pulling his hidden knife. Kano simply caught that wrist and squeezed the bones together. The knife fell and stuck into the floor. A moment later, the Inquisitor was out of air and thrashing.
"How many remain upstairs?"
Kano relaxed his bicep enough to let his victim get a breath.
"Tell me, and I'll let you live."
"Two,"
he lied. Kano knew there was double that, possibly more. It was a good effort on the Inquisitor's part, trying to get him killed like that. He could respect it. But he snapped the man's neck anyway because he had a job to do. Devadas had asked him to protect Radha. That obligation didn't end simply because he'd been bitten by a tiger, stabbed 6 times, and then been left for dead face down in a lake. He dumped the body quietly, gathering his jars, and then proceeded to the top floor. There was a small landing with 2 doors. He'd watched the windows, so he knew Koja slept in the last room, and that was where he had just received the message from the Grand Inquisitor. Pausing to sharpen his hearing, Kano found that there was movement in both rooms, and from the sounds of steel clanking and leather creaking, Koja had already passed on Oman's orders. They were arming up, preparing for their raid. He unscrewed the lids of both jars. Even holding his breath, the vapors that came out made his eyes water. He tried the first door. It was unlocked. He opened it to reveal there were 2 inquisitors inside, dressing in dark clothing and buckling on sword belts. Before either could react, he hurled the jars across the room. They spun, dumping their glittering contents through the air. Then Kano closed that door to let them sort it out. The angry shouts turned to screaming, and then coughing. As they desperately flung themselves at the door to open it, Kano just placed his bulk against it to hold it closed. Kano was immovable. He pulled the smith's hammer from his belt and waited for the rest to react to the noise. It didn't take long. The other door flew open, and an inquisitor ran out. She was dressed as a slave of the Great House, a common enough sight in the market, so that told him what their plan to snatch Radha had been. She produced a pair of knives from seemingly out of nowhere and came at him, jabbing and slashing. The Inquisitor was very good. Kano was better. Keeping most of his weight against the door so the others couldn't escape, he intercepted one blade with the hammer's handle, then knocked the other aside with his palm, and then the first again by catching her forearm with his elbow. She kicked him in the thigh. He took it. She slouched for his neck. He smashed the hammer into her arm. A good impact, but only enough to bruise flesh, not break bones. She cried out and retreated. Another inquisitor rushed into the hall, carrying a curved sword. It was relatively short, but still had more reach than his little worker's hammer. The thumping to his back had weakened. Either they were dying, or one of them had run off to try and climb out the window. So Kano stepped away as the sword zipped through the air to rebound off the wood. The door flew open, temporarily blocking the swordsman. An inquisitor spilled out, clawing at his eyes and wheezing. Kano shoved him, sending him flipping over the railing where he bounced headfirst off the stairs below. A horrible, tear-inducing cloud rolled into the hall. Hopefully the place would air out before the watch arrived. He didn't want to harm any law-abiding people. But these scheming inquisitors?
To the oceans with them.
The swordsman pushed past the door.
Carno kicked it into him, putting him off balance. Then he pushed forward. The curved blade came up in a disemboweling arc, but Carno knew all the tricks.
He'd spent decades learning how to apply brute power and blunt force against the best swordsman in the world. This was child's play for a man who'd learned from Ratul and trained with the likes of Ashok or Devadas. He kept driving forward, not giving the swordsman room to work. The woman darted past both of them. He swung for her head, but she dived forward, rolled, and came right back up. One of her knives zipped through his rags, but missed his skin. Only now he had an enemy on both sides. Oh, she was very good indeed. The three of them shifted back and forth. The smaller inquisitors lunged at their bigger target, but then danced back before he could strike them. The poorly constructed landing shook beneath their feet. The poor things actually thought they had him. He had no time for this foolishness, so Karna called upon the heart of the mountain to grant him speed. They did not see that coming. The edge of the sword was meant for his head, but he caught it with the hammer, hooked it sharply downward, and then brought the chunk of iron back into the Inquisitor's face. Teeth flew, blood sprayed the walls. He turned as the woman's knife missed his back, spinning into her, and the hammer clipped her shoulder hard enough to break her collarbone. She stumbled. He kicked her through the railing. She bounced off the far wall, missed the stairs, and plummeted the four stories into the middle of the textile shop. The swordsman swung desperately. Karna stepped inside, blocked it, arm to arm. He latched onto the sleeve with his free hand and twisted, grinding joints, leveraging the man down. When the back of his skull was exposed, Karno hit him with the hammer, a solid whack, right to the base of the neck. The impact planted the Inquisitor hard enough to break the floorboards beneath. The Protector looked up to see Koja standing in the final room, staring at him, furious. Karno's rags had slipped during the fight, allowing the witch hunter to see his face.
"I was told you were dead."
"They were mistaken, Witch Hunter Koja." He nodded in greeting. "Rada is in my protection. I will not let you harm her."
"I didn't want to. I had a very good plan to sneak her out alive, but you ruined it. If she dies now, it's on your head."
The last Inquisitor he had gassed stumbled onto the landing in a red haze. Karno brained him with a hammer. But that momentary distraction had been all that the experienced Koja had needed, because when Karno looked back, the man was gone, replaced with a tiger. And it leapt out the window. Karno ran over, only to see that the sleek form was bounding swiftly away, leaping across the darkened rooftops of Vidal City, heading straight for the walls of the great house. The Protector climbed out of the window and gave chase. Chapter 35. Rada was sitting in her room reading a book, as was her after-dinner custom, when all the shouting started. That was most unusual. The great house was usually rather peaceful after dark. Harta had no patience for frivolity. Even the soldiers, whom she imagined were as raucous as all young men tended to be, remained extremely polite and professional when their Thakor was in residence.